Okay, so I'm going to be covering biological psychology, which is the third component in the Edexcel Psychology A level module. It's also the third component in the AS, and it is bullet point three, and we'll start off with 3.1.1, which is the central nervous system, which is the CNS, neurotransmitters in human behaviours, including the structure and role of the neuron, the function of neurotransmitters, and synaptic transmission. So the central nervous system starts off with the brain and the spinal cord. The spinal cord is made up of neurotransmitters, which starts off with the cell body and the axon, which is made up of myelin sheath and nodes of ganglia and the axon terminal. Synaptic transmission is between the terminal of one axon and dendrites of the next axon. There is a gap. This gap is referred to as the synaptic gap, also known as synaptic gap. Receptors are like locks. If a certain neurotransmitter fits like a key in the lock, the message is received and continues along that neuron to another neuron. At the dendrites of a neuron, there are receptors of different shapes ready to receive neurotransmitters from other neurons. If the neurotransmitter fits the receptor, the message is passed along. If the neurotransmitter does not fit, the message is blocked. You're going to need some definitions for the central nervous system. So dendrites are the branches at the top of the neuron that receives the message from other neurons. The nucleus contains the genetic material for that particular neuron. The cell body is the main part of the cell that contains the nucleus. The nodes of ganglia are the gaps between the myelin sheath. The myelin sheath is a fatty deposit that provides electrical insulation for an axon and allows electrical nerve impulses to be passed along. Axon is the long branch from the cell body that passes electrical impulses down to the end of the neuron. The axon terminal is at the end of the axon that leads to the terminal buttons, and the terminal buttons are at the very end of the neuron where the nerve impulse becomes a chemical method that can be passed to the dendrite of another neuron. We're also going to need to know how neurons work. Dendrites receive an electrical signal within the cell. The cell body sends the electrical signal down the axon, and the myelin sheath protects the axon. The nodes of ganglia speed up the electrical impulse. The signal reaches the axon terminal and triggers the release of neurotransmitters into the synaptic gap. If the dendrites of the next neuron matches the neurotransmitter released by the first neuron, the signal continues to trigger an action potential down the axon of the next neuron. Neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are chemical messengers that carry messages from one neuron to another. They allow the brain to process thought and memories. Neurotransmitters are released into the synaptic gap, then taken up by the receptors of dendrites of another neuron. They can also block messages. In this case, they are left in the synaptic gap and then reused. And they're also going to need to know about a few hormones for the CNS. So, norepinephrine affects attention, prepares for fight or flight. Dopamine controls addiction, pleasures, and feelings. Serotonin controls your happiness, good mood. Low levels give depression. So that is the end of 3.1.1. So now we're going to look at 3.1.2, which in the specification says the effect on recreational drugs on the transmission process in the central nervous system. So selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, also referred to as SSRIs, is an example of a legal drug which is prescribed for depression, and it works by blocking the reuptake of serotonin, leaving it in the synapse, which allows it to be taken up again by another neuron, and so improving someone's mood. Fluoxetine Prozar is a drug that mimic neurotransmitters. Some are so similar in shape to the real neurotransmitters that they bond with the receptor site and create the reaction, and this is also an example of an agonist. Others are taken up by the receptor site, stopping real neurotransmitters from bonding to the sites, but not creating the reaction, and there are antagonists. You're also going to need to know what the term drug means. The term drug means any substance that is psychoactive, which means mind-altering, and there are three different categories of drug that we need to know about. Legal drugs such as alcohol, painkillers, and tobacco are usually bought over the counter in shops, supermarkets, or pharmacies. Illegal drugs such as cannabis, ecstasy, and cocaine, they are controlled drugs. They are often the type that lead to addiction or have dangerous side effects. But sometimes they are also referred to as recreational drugs, as people tend to take them for fun. Medicinal drugs, such as steroids, you can only get in hospitals. Drug use is drug taking through which harm may occur, although such harm may not be immediately noticeable. Treatment is through education, advice and prevention work. Drug misuse is where drug taking harms health or a person's ability to function. Someone who misuses drugs may be dependent on the drug. To treat the person would require medical help. Any use of drugs can cause harm or even death. Stimulants increase the neutral activity of the central nervous system to produce increases in breathing, heart rate and blood pressure, aggression, paranoia and CD. Caffeine, cocaine and nicotine are examples of this. On the other hand, we also have depressants, and depressant drugs suppress the neural activity of the CNS and in turn decrease breathing, heart rate and blood pressure. Examples of these are alcohol and solvent, overdose due to respiratory depression, liver damage and heart problems. And then there are also hallucinogens. Hallucinogenic drugs act on the brain to alter the perception of what is real. They modify perceptions of thought, sounds and images that flood our brain on a daily basis. LSD, PCP and magic mushrooms are examples of this, and risks might include uncontrollable behaviours such as sickness and flashbacks. Some key terms for this section include mode of action, which means how it works on the body. Effects, consider both the short-term and long-term effects. Tolerance is the body's ability to increasingly withstand the effects and therefore requiring larger quantities of the substance to bring about the desired result. Dependency, what is the physical and psychological need of on the drug. Withdrawal, what are the symptoms? Nicotine releases more neurotransmitters in response to an impulse and increases the number of impulses, so therefore more dopamine in the reward system. Cocaine blocks the reuptake of dopamine. Cannabis, blind to CBI receptors and blocks activity, also affects GABAergic neurons and stop them from inhibiting dopamine production in the reward system, so therefore more dopamine is present. We also need to know what heroin is. Heroin is a highly addictive drug derived from morphine, which is obtained from the opium poppy. It is a depressant that affects the brain's pleasure systems and interferes with the brain's ability to perceive pain. So the short-term effects of heroin, it creates internal euphoria from warm flushing of skin, functioning is cloudy, slurred speech, vomiting and also constipation. However, the long-term effects of heroin are collapsed veins, infection of the heart lining and valves, abscesses, cellulitis and liver disease, pulmonary complications including various types of pneumonia. In addition to the effects of the drug itself, street heroin may have additives that do not really dissolve and result in clogging of the blood vessels that lead to the lungs, liver, kidneys or brain. This can cause infection or even death of small patches of cells in vital organs. With chronic use of heroin, the brain may stop producing endorphins, natural pain-killing chemicals, because it has gotten used to the heroin. That is, the brain shows a change in its circularity and only functions normally in the presence of heroin. The user must replace the missing endorphins with heroin in order to feel well. And that is why people get so addicted to heroin from the first time they take it. But the withdrawal side of heroin is that when heroin is taken away, neurons that have long been inhibited start pumping out neurotransmitters again. This imbalance of chemicals in the brain interacts with the nervous system to produce the classic opaque withdrawal symptoms, which are nausea, muscle spasms, cramps, anxiety, fever, diarrhea. These symptoms can be very serious and the abuser will use the drug again to avoid the withdrawal syndrome. Nicotine is part of the nightshade family and it has been used as an insecticide and makes up 0.6 to 3% of dry weight tobacco. It stimulates acetylcholine synapses associated with thinking and learning. It stimulates endorphins and it can pass into the brain's blood supply within 7 seconds. It stimulates glucose and adrenaline. Glucose inhibits appetite, and adrenaline in the blood substitutes alertness. Physiological dependency is rapid for nicotine. Levels reduce, so irritability increases, concentration suffers, and response is slow. Body can only function right with nicotine in the bloodstream. If the levels drop, headache and stomach becomes upset. Psychological dependency, need to remove symptoms of withdrawal, reward gained and reinforced, breaking the habit, they may feel lost in certain situations. However, the withdrawal of nicotine makes you very irritable, poor concentration, anger and anxiety peak quickly but maintain for 3 or so weeks. Headaches, tingling sensations, constipation, insomnia, tiredness, increase of inappetite, and loss of concentration. And these last about a month. And that is the end of 3.1.2, which has covered the effects of recreational drugs on transmission process in the central nervous system. So now we're going to start 3.1.3, which in the specification is the structure of the brain, different areas, including the prefrontal cortex, the brain functioning, and an explanation of anger as human behaviour. There are 4 lobes to the brain: the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, the occipital lobe, and the patriarchal lobe. The frontal lobe is higher mental functions concerned with language and speech, creating, problem solving, reasoning, planning, movement and emotions. Pituitary lobe is sensory processing, so it's learned skills and gestures, body sense and position, object perception, scale, space perception and spelling and calculation. The temporal lobe focuses on memory of events, so episodic memory, memory of fact, which is semantic memory, auditory processing, language and understanding speech and smell. And finally, the occipital lobe is colour, shape, motion and visual processing. And the brain is split into 2 halves. You've got the left and the right hand side of the brain. The left hand side of the brain takes care of analytical thought, detailed orientation perception, ordered sequencing, rational thought, verbal, cautious, planning, mathematical and science based, logical, right field of vision and right side motor skills. So the left hand side of your brain controls the right hand side of your body. So the right hand side of the brain then controls intuitive thought, holistic perception, random sequences, emotional thought, non-verbal, it's more adventurous and impulsive, creative writing and art, imagination, and it also controls the left field of vision and left side motor skills. So then your right side of the brain is controlling the left hand side of your body. So the 2 parts of your brain are joined together by the corpus callosum, and women have a slightly enlarged corpus callosum, enabling them to switch better between tasks. So there are some methodological issues in assuming brain damage assumes brain function. Research is done using case studies, so therefore each case is individual and unique. We assume the observed behaviour is linked to the damage, however there could be underlying issues. Research techniques may not be sophisticated enough to identify specific areas. And we're also going to look at brain structure and aggression. The prefrontal cortex is identified by PET, MRI and fMRI scans. The cortex is the outer layer. Below the cortex is the subcortex. The prefrontal cortex consists of orbital cortex, the lateral prefrontal cortex and ventromedial cortex and other bits, but they're just the bits we need to be aware of. The lower the activity in the prefrontal cortex, the greater the chance of depression. Aggression is linked to a lack of regulation in the prefrontal cortex. Many links with dopamine, serotonin and neferine. Orbital frontal cortex is linked to our accepting delayed gratification and deferring rewards. The ventromedial cortex is linked to the experience of emotions. The lateral prefrontal cortex is linked to making choices, as we can see different options. The left hemisphere controls the positive emotions and the right hemisphere controls the negative emotions. The left hemisphere also communicates with the amygdala and in the limbic system. So we also need to know about aggression. So Becara and van der Linden in 2005 did a meta-analysis on decision-making links with the ventromedial cortex. Damage links to not being able to make long-term plans, immediate reward. The prefrontal cortex is for regulating behaviour and emotion, so damage can lead to an inability
ability to control aggressive behaviour. Prefrontal cortex inhibits the amygdala. Other regions of the prefrontal cortex is the dorsolateral region. This is linked to inhibition and impulse control. So some evidence to support this is Rain in 98, not the 97 study, that's something different, compared impulsive violent versus planned violent offenders using PET scans. The lower functioning from the impulse offenders in their lower left and right lack regulation that occurs in the prefrontal cortex.
So we also need to look at the limbic system, and that contains the hippocampus, which is basically focused around memory, the hypothalamus, which is eating and day and night cycle. The amygdala relates to emotional responses, temperature, fight or flight, and response to emotions, not thinking. So the hypothalamus balances the body, so that does homeostasis. Like a thermostat, it controls your hunger and thirst, it responds to pain, aggression, and sexual satisfaction. It regulates automatic parts of the nervous system, your blood pressure, your pulse, your breathing, and arousal levels. It detects levels of leptin, which is released if we overeat, sensing the levels of fat in the body, and it controls our appetite. So your amygdala controls your fight or flight situations, and it's used to identify threat and promote self-preservation. So now we're going to look on some tests on animals involving the limbic system. So Andy and Bellamati in 1978 did a study on cats, where they stipulate the hypothalamus and the basal ganglia to see if it causes aggression, and they measured that by the amount of hissing and growling, and blocking neurotransmitters increased aggression. Hermans in 1993 found electrical stimulation of hypothalamus gives aggression. So we're going to have a look at some neurotransmitters again. Delville et al. In 1997 found that low levels of serotonin is linked to aggression. Neurotransmitters are linked to the brain functioning as they allow the different areas to communicate. Using animals, Blanchard in 2003 said that it's reasonable to link conclusions with animal aggression to human aggression. Humans, like animals, protect territory and compete for resources like status. Suggested a link to the endocrine system rather than the amygdala, but they suggest all studies with animals can be linked to humans. So we're going to look at some strengths for this. There's lots of evidence for the prefrontal cortex, limbic system, and the amygdala to be linked to aggression. Animal studies like electric impulse through the hypothalamus lead to increased aggression. PET and fMRI scans allow us to isolate the brain structures and activity measured. MRIs allow us to measure volumes. Techniques allow us to be scientific, and techniques are credible. We also need some weaknesses to counter-argue this. So humans and animals have different prefrontal cortexes amongst other parts of the brain. Also, other factors are different, such as consciousness, and can't be generalised to humans. Scanning is reliable, however, may not be valid. Scanning takes place in an artificial setting with artificial activity, so the brain may not function normally. Gorka in 2013 had people drink, then look at different emotions on faces, where they then tested amygdala connectivity. And that is the end of 3.1.3. So now we're going to start 3.1.4, which in the specification says the role of evolution and natural selection to explain human behaviour, including aggression. So the evolutionary causes of aggression. So we need to know the basics of evolution, which is we are created from ape-like ancestors, but not actual apes, and natural selection and genetic mutation over time has caused us to change as a species. So we're going to look at natural selection. So the species best adapted to the environment, they live longer and have a better chance of procreating. These survival traits become more common over time until all ancestors have them. Aggression is an important survival trait, which is why the limbic system and hormones produce aggression. Too little aggression and you don't get enough to eat or reproduce, and too much and you get killed. So we're going to have a look at some genetic mutations, and these are not just cats with thumbs. We are amalgamations of our parents' genes, but these are copies, aren't identical, they are mutations. Most mutations are negative and predisposition for cancer, but sometimes they can be good. Longer necks on a giraffe means they can reach more food. Over time, positive mutations can become survival traits. Creatures with very short lifespans, like many flies and viruses can evolve dramatically in just a few years. Creatures like humans with longer lifespans tend to take millions of years to evolve. And we're now going to look at survival of the fittest, which is not Darwin, but still evolution. It refers to how fit the genes of an animal are, the ones that produce survival traits. The fitter you are, the more adaptive and suitable you are to an environment. So aggression and evolution. We need to be able to live in peace. If we couldn't, we wouldn't procreate. But aggression aids survival, so it gives us defence from predators and catching food. What is key is we can turn aggression on and off. So the limbic system with the amygdala interprets threats and creates fight or flight. The hypothalamus triggers testosterone production when threatened. The prefrontal cortex allows us to overrule our reactions, allowing us to ignore them, which also aids survival. So we need to be able to link evolutionary aggression to real life. So sexual jealousy, their genes will get passed on and not yours. Irrational jealousy is obviously not attractive. It can be seen as a weakness, so our prefrontal cortex can turn it off. David Buss in 1988 identified two mate reaction strategies used by males to control their partners. Direct guarding of the female restricts her movements. Negative inducements to prevent her straying, including things like financial control or the threat of violence. Shacklich et al. In 2005 surveyed 461 men and 560 women in committed relationships. They found a positive correlation between men who used mate retention techniques, so direct guarding and negative inducements, and their use of violence. The women's results confirmed this correlation. Men also tended to use emotional manipulation as a mate retention technique, a form of non-physical aggression. Social aggression. Being constantly physically aggressive opens us up to threats on our lives and can reduce the likelihood of our survival to procreate. So humans have high levels of social aggression. Indirect aggression, which is covert, such as spreading malicious gossip. Rational aggression is overt but non-physical, such as breaking off a friendship, pulling faces or bitchiness. Social aggression allows members of the group who may be physically weak but verbally or socially skillful, quick-witted, perceptive, good at lying, to achieve power without the risk of that come from physical confrontations. This survival trait for them and other members of the group might benefit, since social aggression might unite the group against an unpopular minority or keep potential troublemakers from being too attractive. This ties with Tajfel's social identity theory that we naturally form in-groups and discriminate against out-groups. Evolutionary psychology explains why we have the urge to do this. So an evaluation of this. Objections. Aggressive animals don't live as long, so can't procreate, so aggression should die out. Darwin's theory is adapted for this group selection. The individuals survive as they are part of a group that their aggression benefits. Creationists believe the theory goes against the Bible. However, psychology stands within science, as does biology, and they base their theories on scientific evidence rather than faith. And that is the end of 3.1.4. So we're now going to start 3.1.5, which in the specification is the biological explanation of aggression as an alternative to Freud's psychodynamic explanation, referring to the different parts of the personality, so the id, the ego and the superego, and the importance of the unconscious and catharsis. So we're going to start off by looking at Freud and his assumptions. So assumption number one is in the first 5 years we form our personality. The second assumption is that the three stages of psychosexual development are in these first 5 years. The third assumption is the unconscious controls 95% of our behaviour. And the fourth assumption is that the libido part of our ID and the driving force for our behaviour. So Freud also believed in a conscious, the preconscious and the unconscious. So the conscious is what we are aware of, and we're aware of these feelings. The preconscious is near the surface, accessible in memories. The unconscious is what we're unaware of and it is suppressed. So the id, the ego and the superego. The id is that I want it now, and the first to develop in the unconscious, and it's the pleasure principle. The ego tries to achieve the id's desires and it looks to satisfy, and it works on the reality principle and develops around 18 months. The superego, you can't have. the morality principle given to us by our parents, what is right and what is wrong, and arrives between 3 to 5 years. And we also have some basic drives. So the libido controls self-preservation, the eros is life instinct, and the thanatos is the individual wants to go back to a state of not being, provides energy to allow the ego to inhibit sexual instinct and allows aggression to be channeled through sport. So protection and repression. To balance the inappropriate wants of life, the id, against the hypermoralistic restrictions of the superego and the ego, represses the unacceptable thought into the unconscious mind. These wants control our behaviour even though we don't know about them. If these thoughts were to return to the conscience, we would not be able to be free of them. So why are we aggressive? The aggression helps to preserve life, the libido, as the death instinct, so thanatos, is subdued by it. Frustration leads to aggression, not instant gratification of the id, for example. As a child, the superego child's conscience can be frustrated if it doesn't get its way, so it becomes frustrated, so aggressive. Our love for our parents stops aggression, but it is not released, so it builds up, and we need to channel it to release the aggression. So thanatos can help to channel it to other outlets like sport. Aggression, according to Freud, can be cathartic in that when it is brought to the conscious mind and released, it means the energy can be spent elsewhere. This catharsis can be doing other aggressive behaviours, so computer games, thumb wards. He even said watching or reading about violent behaviour can be effective. So some arguments for this argument. Hawkinson in 1974 said behaviour aggressively reduces tension, so demonstrated by biological measures. For Rona and Sullivan in 08, those who reacted aggressively to a frustrating task had a lower heart rate than those who were not aggressive. And some arguments opposing Freud's theory. Hawkinson again gave a counter-argue in the same year of 1974. Reduction in tension from aggressive behaviour led to an increased likelihood of aggression, so it doesn't support the idea it calms us down. Bushman in 1999, technically reading that hitting a punch bag should be as cathartic as doing it itself. In this study, those that read about it were more likely to be aggressive. The knowledge led to more aggression. The talking cure. Neurosis and natural unaware, psychosis not aware, and hysterical Anna O couldn't see, but why? And that is the end of 3.1.5. So now we're on to 3.1.6, which is the role of hormones, so testosterone, for example, to explain human behaviours such as aggression. So hormones are chemical messengers which transmit information all around the body, and these affect much more slowly than neurotransmitters, usually over a few minutes or a couple of hours. Most hormones are produced by a set of glands in the body called the endocrine system. And hormones are carried through the body in the blood. When they reach their target cells, they bind to the cell and change it. Its function. Cells respond in particular ways to particular hormones. Some hormones reach the brain and bring about mood changes by altering the production or reuptake of neurotransmitters. For example, testosterone is linked to the feelings of aggression. They can affect growth, metabolism and mood, and amongst other things. Oxytocin is released by the posterior pituitary gland and is linked to increasing of trust between people. Hormones can be prescribed as a medication. Estrogen and proestrogen work as contraceptives. Insulin is used by diabetics, and steroids can treat sick skin problems and inflammation. So testosterone. Testosterone is an androgen, which is a chemical that maintains and develops male characteristics. And we all have testosterone, but men have significantly more than women. Antenatal exposure to testosterone helps to organise the developing brain, leading to better spatial awareness and competitive aggression. After birth, testosterone stimulates the growth of the amygdala and hypothalamus. So some arguments for: hormones such as testosterone have been linked to aggression. A study of 89 prisoners by Dabbs et al. In 1987 and 1995 found testosterone levels were higher in those who had been convicted of a violent crime. Those with high testosterone levels were rated higher by other prisoners for being tough. Barsman in 2013 and Salvia of 7 to 9 year olds boys in psychiatric hospitals, they looked for DHEA, testosterone, and cortisol. They also got the nurses to rate each child on their aggression. There was a positive correlation between cortisol levels and the number of aggressive incidents. Testosterone is linked to dominance among animals. It tends to peak in the mating season when male animals such as red deer fight for dominance. In Chang, in the year 12, fish, levels of testosterone and cortisol positively correlate with boldness, explanatory aggressive behaviour amongst fish. Testosterone has also been shown to peak when the human males are single, decline when they got married, and peak again after divorce or separation. And that was by Matzer and Booth in 1998. Measures in these studies are quantitative and therefore more scientific. They use numerous research methods, providing different types of evidence, making the research more scientifically credible. However, there are some weaknesses. Research is correlational, so it cannot identify cause and effect. There could be other variables. Aggressive behaviour is much more than just hormones. It's more holistic, taking into account hormones and neurotransmitters and brain functioning, and even social explanations, including individual differences. And that is the end of 3.1.6. So we're now going to look at 3.2.1, which is correlational research. So the use of correlational research method in psychology, including covariables, types of correlation, positive and negative, including the use of scatter diagrams, issues surrounding the use of correlations in psychology, and issues with cause and effect, including other variables. So correlation studies. Facebook is all about friends. The more friends you have, the happier you will be. That means there is a positive correlation between friends and happiness. A correlation is a relationship between two variables where changes in one variable go along with changes in other variables. There are two types of correlations. A positive correlation is where the variable changes in the same direction, like friends and happiness. A negative correlation is where the variable changes in opposite directions. As friends increase, loneliness will decrease. The coefficient of correlation. If you're reporting your research, you couldn't just say that the line slopes up to the right a bit or it looks positive. There is a mathematical value for any correlation. We call this the coefficient of the correlation. A coefficient of 0.00 means there is no relationship between the variable. If we compared the number of friends to people have to percent the mark they got in their year 7 French exam, we might just find there was just no connection. Sally got 70% and Billy got 30%, but they both have 120 friends. Continually, a value of positive 1.00 means a perfect positive correlation. The more hours you work, the more money you will get. If there is a 100% correspondence between the two, then the correlation would be positive 1.00. A value of negative 1.00 means a perfect negative correlation. The more money you spend, the less you have in the bank. There could be a 100% negative correlation between spending and saving. However, in the real world, you don't often find perfect correlations. Usually they are weaker. However, there are three advantages of correlations. The first one is they may indicate a connection between two issues in situations where experimental proof is impossible. Secondly, they do not require manipulation of variables and they're therefore safer and more ethical than doing experiments on humans. And finally, ecological validity. These numbers came from real life tests. And then there are two disadvantages to correlation. One is that they do not prove a causal relationship, and the second is they do not reflect curvilinear relationships. However, there are also some problems with correlations. So correlations show linear relationships but do not reflect curvilinear ones. So for example, the effect of stress on an exam performance. Correlation shows a straight line but is really a curve. Correlations demonstrate that there may be a relationship between two sets of data, but they don't show what the cause is. You have to try and work out the relationship, and it doesn't Don't fall for the trap of thinking that one aspect automatically causes the other. And then there's also the third variable problem. Does violent crime make people buy more ice cream? Does eating ice cream cause violent crime? Or is there a third variable which is causing both? And that is the end of 3.2.1. And before we go into the next section, 3.2.2 is in the methodological section, which I've put with social and cognitive psychology. So we're now going to look at 3.2.3, which is other biological research methods, so brain scanning techniques, so CAT, PET and fMRI, the use of brain scanning techniques to investigate human behaviour such as aggression, and then we have to look at one twin study and an adoption study. So the twin study I'm going to use is the Gottesman and Shields 1996, and the adoption is going to be Ketty, which is 1968. So brain scanning techniques. Scans have the same underpinning ideas but use different ways to get these pictures. CT or CAT scanning is an X-ray used to get the picture. PET scanning is a radioactive tracer that is used. MRI is magnetic functioning and fMRI is functional magnetic imaging. So CT scanning. X-ray computed tomography is known as a CAT or a CT scan. CAT stands for computed or computerized tomography. CT and CAT scans are similar. The difference is the axial part of the CAT scan, which is about the angle of the slices, and that no longer applies to CT, so is now the term used. Tomography is about imaging using sections. It takes a slice of and produces a drawing of the slices. X-ray does not help when structures overlap because they cannot see behind. CT scans don't have the overlap issue as the images are in sections. In psychology, CT can be used to understand damage to the brain. So how does CT scanning work? A CT scan produces pictures and slices which can be viewed individually or can be put together to give a 3D view of the whole area being scanned. Older CT scans involve slices but never one to take pictures on a helix shape. The pictures are formed and pick up how the area being scanned reacts to the X-ray being passed through it, which shows for how far the X-ray is blocked. Knowing how areas block the X-ray can show things about the area, such as if a tumour is present. The procedure for CT scanning is for the patient to either lie on a moving platform to be passed through the scanner, or the patient lies still and the scanner moves around them. Sometimes a dye, so iodine or barium, is used for highlighting purposes, which can be injected into the bloodstream and is used to make the picture clearer for analysis. The scan can take anywhere from a few minutes to 30 minutes. CT scanning is used mostly for medical purposes to check damage on the brain. So some strengths for CT scanning. CT scanning is less harmful than PET scans, which use radioactive tracers. CT scans can detect changes in physical structures, so it's good when looking at hemorrhages and tumours. And it has a wide application, including studying the damage to the brain. The use of the modern helix formation means different angles of an area of interest can be studied, and CT scans are not painful and are non-invasive unless a dye is used. However, there are some weaknesses, such as the X-ray can be damaging, so have to be used infrequently, so CT scanning would not be recommended for brain research purposes due to the risk of damage formed using X-rays, for example, cancer. MRI gives a clearer picture, so it's more likely to be used when scanning the brain, and radiation from a CT scan is equal to what a person would normally be exposed to over the course of a year. So now we'll look at PET scanning. So Position emission tomography, so PET, picks up hot spots in the brain, which means the researchers can find out what parts of the brain are working at a certain time. PET scanning can also show the size of brain areas, which can be measured and compared between people. And Rain did that piece of research. PET scans can give 3D images by using CT and PET scanning together. PET CT scanning is a modern advance on PET scanning. PET and CT scans are done one after another, and then the areas of malfunctioning can be highlighted in the body, not usually used when studying the brain. PET MRI scans combine PET and MRI to see functioning so a fuller picture can emerge. The functioning is what the body is doing biochemically. PET scanning gives the functioning only head and brain are covered using a PET MRI. So So how does PET scanning work? A PET scan can be used to study blood flow in the brain. For example, if someone talks during a PET scan, the area of most blood flow in the brain will be the area used during the talking. A radioactive tracer is added to a chemical that the body uses, usually glucose, which is injected into a vein in the arm. The tracer provides small positively charged particles called positrons, which give signals that are recorded. As the glucose is used in the brain, it shows up as the area of activity. The recordings can be displayed as images, which are then interpreted. Different radioactive tracers are used depending on which information is required. PET scanning is linked to shorter tasks, as the radioactive tracer does not last as long. So, some strengths of PET scanning. PET scanning is reasonably non-invasive, although there is the injection of the tracer, which is invasive, and the images are taken outside the body, which is less dangerous than surgery. PET scanning is reliable because it can be repeated and the same results can be found. The same areas of the brain are consistently found for different activities. For example, this reliability is if someone speaks during a PET scan, the same area of the brain will be used each time. Weaknesses. The use of a radioactive tracer is invasive, so therefore there are ethical implications for the individual. The scan itself can make people panic because it is a claustrophobic experience. As always, informed consent must be given. It is difficult to precisely isolate different brain functioning. For example, people can read passages of a text during a scan, but they would almost certainly be using other parts of their brain as well. What is magnetic resonance imaging, also known as MRI? MRI scans give cross-sectional views of the body, like a CT scan, and can produce images from different angles. MRI scans do not show activity to the same degree as PET scans, and they are used to look at a structure, not function, what there is, e.g. a measurement of grey matter in the brain. When used for medical purposes, MRI scans can detect different cancers depending on the area of the body being scanned. Before an MRI is carried out, a dye called a contrast medium can sometimes be injected into the body to help show the body's organs and relevant areas. During scanning, the whole body may be outside the tube, which may be claustrophobic. So how does MRI scanning work? A strong magnetic field is passed over the body. This excited hydrogen atoms, which can be detected by the scanner. The process is noisy but not painful. MRI scans are affected by movements, so the person has to keep really still. The effect of passing the magnetic field over the chosen area is measured, and images are produced which are interpreted. The time it takes for the hydrogen atoms to return to their resting state can show things about the tissue in the body. There's some strengths about MRI scans. MRI scanning is a more ethical way of studying the brain and the rest of the body, unless the contrast medium is used. MRI scanning is replicable, so it can be repeated and the same results found. MRI scanning is preferred over CT scanning because it's less harmful. Studies have shown that radiation from CT scanning is harmful and can cause cancers. However, there are also some weaknesses with MRI scanning. MRI scans may be stressful if the injections are given. They are also extremely noisy and can make people feel closed in. This sort of stress should not be imposed on a patient without careful consideration of ethical guidelines. MRI scanning is scanning only measures particular things. They can generate clear images of soft tissue and the body, but brain activity is not measured. This means that knowledge from scans like this is limited. So we also need to know what functional magnetic resonance imaging is, which is also known as an fMRI scan. fMRI scanning builds on MRI scanning and can look at the function of the brain. The scans measure the blood and oxygen levels. fMRI is not as good when used for people with brain damage, and as brain damage affects blood flow. However, it is useful for finding out how brain functions when used with normal patients. fMRI is used in psychology for looking at regions of the brain when we use language and seeing if both sides of the brain are used equally, checking memory regions, looking for the onset of Alzheimer's, and looking at mental health issues such as depression to see if there are effects on brain functioning. fMRI scanning, like MRI scanning, uses a magnetic field. The scan picks up on changes of use of the brain areas depending on the tasks being done. fMRI relies on blood flow and neurological activity being linked, so changes in blood flow highlight neurological activity. Oxygenated and deoxygenated hemoglobin is looked at using magnetic resonance imaging to see which areas of the brain activate certain conditions. So some strengths for an fMRI scan. With fMRI, there is no danger of invasion or radiation exposure, unlike CT and PET scanning. The detection of blood flow is very precise, so the extent that even slight changes can be detected. This means that for medical use, fMRI is good at detecting issues around strokes. The sensitivity of blood flow changes, making fMRI very good for looking at brain functioning and brain structure when it comes to learning about the brain. However, weaknesses of an fMRI. fMRI cannot look at the actual receptors of neurotransmitters, whereas PET scans can. Too much movement from the participant can distort the scanning. In an fMRI, the idea is to have a resting state and a functional experimental state. However, the brain is never at rest, so it is not easy to get a baseline measurement, e.g. even breathing requires processing from the brain, and there are risks of undergoing an fMRI for people with issues such as claustrophobia or pacemakers. So we need to look at brain scanning to investigate aggression. So Rain et al. In 1997 studied PET scanning, where PET scanning was used to investigate aggression. He found brain differences between murderers compared to non-murderers. Differences suggested that aggressive behaviour may be from certain brain structures. Betts in 2009 looked at CAT scanning, a review about people pleading not guilty by reasons of insanity. He looked at the case of Herbert Weinstein, whose defence used CAT scanning to show that he had damage to the brain that might have led to his aggression, that he strangled his wife. The CAT scan showed some damage, and this evidence was used to persuade the jury that his actions were not thought through, as he did not know right from wrong. And this suggests that aggressive behaviour might be based on someone's brain physiologically, so scanning is a useful research method for investigating human behaviour such as aggression. Matthijs et al. In 2012 looked at MRI scanning, and they used MRI scanning to measure the volume of amygdala in 21 female participants, also collected an aggression score about lifetime aggression. The two scores were tested for a relationship, and a correlation was found. It was found that the smaller the amygdala, the higher the aggression score. This suggests that MRI is helpful in finding out whether aggression might be based on the brain. Brunels et al. In 2013 looked at fMRI scans. Vasopressin is a hormone that promotes the retention of water by the kidney and increased blood pressure. Study to see if taking vasopressin would moderate aggression and calm people down. Used healthy adults who took vasopressin nasally. One group had vasopressin and one had a placebo. They completed a competitive reaction time task that was meant to induce aggression, whilst they had an fMRI scan to see if activity in the brain. No differences were found between the two groups. However, it was found that some evidence that the right superior temporal succulus involved decision making about punishment. So the fMRI does give evidence of the brain functioning might affect human behaviour. However, the behaviour itself was not affected, so the findings are not conclusive. Rainman and Zimbardo in 2011 did a meta-analysis where they looked at the neuroscience of evil. They wanted to see what others had found using brain scanning and other methods about evil and links to the structure and functioning of the brain. They found a number of studies that used neuroimaging to show that the damage to the frontal lobe links with aggressive behaviour within humans. Rainman and Zimbardo show how brain scanning is useful for investigating human behaviour. The main conclusions for investigating 3.2.3 and the brain scanning techniques and the use of these techniques to investigate human behaviour is that the prefrontal cortex area seem to be featured in aggressive behaviour, in that damage to that area can bring aggression. The amygdala seems to be a part of the brain involved in the emotional side of aggression. Mathetes et al. 2012 found that smaller amygdala gave more aggression, which goes against what other studies suggest. However, it has been suggested that having all female participants led to finding this. Widened succuli seem to relate to aggression. So the second part of 3.2.3 is the twin study, and we're looking at the Gottesman and Shields twin study. However, there are alternates depending on what content you want to study. So the aim of this procedure is to see whether schizophrenia had a genetic basis. Using a twin study methodologically, Gottesman and Shields plan to test different twin pairs to investigate the concordance rates of schizophrenia in twins. They also wanted to replicate other studies that had indicated a genetic basis to the disorder to find if their findings would be similar, to test for reliability. So for their sample, they used patient records from a short-stay psychiatric hospital with a large outpatients department, a 16-year history over that time. 392 patients were seen who said that they had a twin of the same sex, and of those 68 had a diagnosis of schizophrenia or related psychosis. Six patients were discounted because their twin counterparts were overseas or it was unclear whether they were monozygotic or dizygotic twins. This left 62 participants, and five twin pairs were both on the register, leaving 57 study pairs. The other 52 patients' twin counterparts were tracked down to participate in the study. So the procedure they followed is, of the 62 patients in the participant sample, exactly half were male and half were female. Their ages ranged from 19 to 64 when they were last assessed, with the average patient age being 32. Zygosity was determined using three methods: fingerprint testing, blood testing, and resemblance assessments, and this was done before DNA testing was around. Multiple data collection methods were used, involving both primary and secondary resources. These included hospital reports, case histories based on self-report questionnaires, and interviews with the twins and their parents. Tape recorded 30-minute samples of verbal behaviour from semi-structured interviews, personality testing, and testing to measure disorders thinking concluded both on the twin sets and their respective parents. And the researchers wanted to look at concordance rates. If one twin had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, they wanted to know how often their counterpart would also be diagnosed with schizophrenia or a related psychosis. The patient who had been admitted to the psychiatric hospital initially first coming to the attention was called the proband. The data was analysed between each proband and their twin, with the twin pairs being categorised in four ways. The first category was both the proband and the co-twin had been hospitalised and diagnosed with schizophrenia. The second category is both had been hospitalised but the co-twin had been given another diagnosis related to schizophrenia. The third category is that the co-twin had some psychiatric abnormality but nothing related to schizophrenia. And the fourth category is that the proband had schizophrenia but the co-twin was diagnosed as clinically normal. In summary, the results showed there was a significant difference found between monozygotic and dizygotic twins in all measures. Monozygotic twins were always more similar in diagnosis than dizygotic twins in each case where the co-twin had some diagnosis. Similarity was greater between female twins compared to male twins for both mono and dizygotic twins. Concordance rates were higher for both mono and dizygotic twins for severe schizophrenia compared to mild schizophrenia. So in conclusion, the findings suggest that the closer the genetic relationship between the two people, the greater the likelihood, if one of them is diagnosed with schizophrenia, that the co-twin is going to develop schizophrenia or a related psychotic disorder. The study also suggests that this relationship was more prevalent among females than males. However, as twins in the monozygotic twin pairs did not have 100% concordance rates, the implication is that schizophrenia is not caused entirely by genes. Instead, the results led Gottesman and Shields to believe that genetic factors do predispose someone to schizophrenia by lowering their threshold for coping with stress, but environmental triggers may also be needed to actually start the development of the disorder. They said that the diathesis stress model best fit this explanation, taking on board a biological and environmental explanation. Gottesman and Shields also looked at 11 other studies and concluded that their results did support each other, although they thought there were some methodological issues, such as with the sampling techniques. This is how they concluded their results were reliable and that there is a genetic element to schizophrenia. So the strengths of Gottesman and Shields' twin studies is that the results are supposed to be backed up by other studies which have produced similar findings, such as in Eugley in 1961, who found that 74% of concordance rate of twins with progressive chronic schizophrenia disorder and 39% concordance rates for mild schizophrenia. One of the findings of their analysis of other studies was that the sampling techniques were questionable, but a strength of Gottman and Shields' study is that sampling was carefully controlled using multiple measurements to make sure that twins were correctly allocated either monozygotic or dizygotic twin status, and a lot of data was gathered using multiple research methods to check the diagnosis were correct. Weaknesses for this study is that it would have been more useful to know more about whether related psychosis meant when what related psychosis meant when describing schizophrenia scale. To take into account the relative disorders as they failed to make this clear. Gottesman and Shields also suggested that they are different types of schizophrenia and some might be caused by life events, so environmental stimuli, such as being a prisoner of war, and it was hard to distinguish between such types in the results of their study. And then also within 3.2.3, we need to look at an adoption study, and we're looking at Ketty for this. So the aim of Ketty's procedure was to find out if there was a genetic basis for schizophrenia. In particular, the researcher compares adoptive family and the biological family of a schizophrenia sufferer, the index participant, to see if there is a higher rate of schizophrenia-related illness among biological relatives than adoptive relatives. So there are some variables in the study. The IV is the independent variable groups design, since it looks at the difference between biological relatives and adoptive relatives of schizophrenia sufferers, also known as index participants. It also looks at the difference between the schizophrenia sufferers and the control group with no history of mental illness. Because of adoption and schizophrenia are naturally occurring variables, this is a natural experiment. DV, the researchers measured prevalence of schizophrenia-related mental illnesses among family members. So Ketty's sample was 34 schizophrenic patients, two of them were monozygotic twins, taken from the Danish adoption register for Copenhagen. They were aged 20 to 43 and were taken from a large sample of 503 adoptees who had been admitted to psychiatric hospitals with generalised mental illnesses. This would be an opportunity sample. B1 was a group of 16 patients with chronic long-term schizophrenia. B2 was a group of 7 with acute short-term or one-off schizophrenia. B3 was a group of 11 borderline schizophrenia or latent schizophrenia. 33 mentally healthy controls were selected from the Danish adoption registry. These were matched to the schizophrenic patients on age, gender, and the age of which they were adopted, and the social class of the adoptive family. So for the procedure, Ketty used the Danish family records to locate adoptive and biologically relatives of all the participants. They tracked down 463 relatives and used the mental health register to assess their mental status. A panel of 4 Danish psychiatrists used the medical records to diagnose the family members this way, a blind test because the psychiatrists did not know whether the records were taken from an adoptive family or a biological family member. Once the diagnosis had been made, the identities were revealed and they were assigned to the adoptive family groups, IA and CI, or two biologically family groups, IB or CB. I meaning index adoptees and biological relatives, IA meaning index adoptees and adoptive relatives, CB meaning control adoptees and biological relatives, and CA meaning control adoptees and adoptive relatives. Blind testing is a great technique to reduce the experimental bias. As the data comes from health records, Ketty and his colleagues did not make personal contact with any of the participants. Ketty replaced the study in 1975 and did seek out participants and interview them. So Ketty's conclusion was that there seems to be a genetic component to schizophrenia because the schizophrenic adoptees were more likely to have schizophrenia in their biological family than their adoptive family. Their biological families were more likely to have schizophrenia than the families of the controls. Ketty then did the Danish-American study and had a huge impact on the study of schizophrenia and helped prove the theory that schizophrenia has a genetic component. The study also supported the diathesis stress model of Ketty's colleague, David Rosenthal. This theory claims that the genes provide a predisposition towards schizophrenia, which can be triggered by stressful life events. This study has a fairly large sample and covers a range of ages from teenagers to men and women in their late 40s. They were taken from the Danish Adoption Register of the Copenhagen area, which should make them representative of Danes in general, perhaps Europeans in general too. Denmark was a preferred location for adoption studies because of its stable and homogeneous population, mostly white and not experiencing much migration in the 20th century. This was a practical benefit, but it might make it hard to generalise the results to other ethnic groups or to more mixed populations. Ketty et al. Developed a very reliable procedure and they replicated it in 1975 and 1978 and then again in 1994, adding interviews in as well. Since they got similar findings, this is test-retest reliability. Ketty also used a group of four psychiatrists who diagnosed each relative based on medical records. Relatives were assigned the category BI and B3, D1 and D3 and C. When these psychiatrists agreed, there were only four cases where the psychiatrists could not agree, and these were removed from the study. This is inter-rater reliability. However, the diagnostic categories were rather vague and dependent on subjective interpretation. Latent schizophrenia and inadequate personality seemed to be especially vague and unscientific because of any odd or eccentric person might be diagnosed as fitting into this category. There are important applications of this study for families with a history of schizophrenia and people looking to adopt a child. If schizophrenia has a genetic component, then even an upbringing among a healthy adoptive family might not prevent a child with a genetic predisposition for schizophrenia becoming ill in later life. However, the diathesis stress model suggests this is only a predisposition and it requires a trigger. If families are aware that a child has a genetic link to schizophrenia, they can guide the child away from drugs and stressful careers and watch out for early symptoms. As well as most mental illnesses, schizophrenia is less destructive if it's diagnosed early. So validity. Ketty's American-Danish adoption studies tie in with earlier research like Gottesman and Shields and Rosenthal's theory of the diathesis stress model of schizophrenia. This gives the American-Danish study concurrent validity from the previous studies and construct validity from the theory. There are still vague and unclear concepts in this theory, in this research. What did Ketty et al. Mean by schizophrenia spectrum? It sounded like a catch-all category that almost anything could fall into. If so, findings that the biological relatives of the index participants were more prone to schizophrenia might be an illusion. Moreover, the researchers did not consider the environment or personal history in detail because they were working off medical records and state registries. The criticisms by Joseph in 2014 suggest there may be deeper problems with the American-Danish study. If Ketty et al. Changed their design to get the results they were looking for, then the findings are invalid because they did not measure what they claimed to measure. So ethically, the participants in the study were not directly approached. Their only data analysed was by the researchers, and this could have been done under Danish laws without needing consent from the participants, which is why Denmark is so popular for studies like this. However, there are still issues of social responsibility, scientific integrity and harm. The researchers had a responsibility to find out if there was a genetic component to schizophrenia. Because of this, they could have a huge benefit in society in general, especially for people who are adopted. However, if Ketty did manipulate the results, then it brings his integrity into question. If he created these false impression that schizophrenia is a genetically inheritable, this may have led to stress and anxiety and prejudice for people from families with history of mental illness. And that is the end of 3.2.3. So we're now going to look at 3.3.1, which is Rain et al. And that was in 1997, which is the brain abnormalities and murders indicated by positron emission tomography. And this is our classic study. So Rain et al.'s 1997 brain abnormalities in murderers indicated by PET studies is the classic biological psychology study. The aim is to investigate the patterns of brain activity in murderers compared to a matched sample of non-murderers using PET scans. The procedure for this was that he used an experimental group of 41 participants charged with murder or manslaughter who had pleaded not guilty by reasons of insanity but had been convicted, and these are referred to as the murderers. The murderers' average age was between 34.3 years. There were 39 men and 2 women, and the murderers had 20, murderers, 23 had a history of brain damage, 6 were schizophrenia, 3 were substance abuse and 2 mood disorders, 2 epilepsy, 3 had a learning disability or hyperactivity, and 2 had paranoid personality disorder. The controls had an average age of 31.7 years. A control group of normal participants was matched for sex, age, and who were similar in other ways, e.g. had 6 had schizophrenia, and no participants were on medication. The independent variable is whether the participant is a murderer or not. The dependent variable is the measures of the brain activity and brain structure found using PET scans. Following a practice test, participants were injected with a radioactive glucose tracer. They did a continuous performance task, a visual task that increased brain activity in the frontal lobes of normal participants for 32 minutes. PET scans were performed immediately after and used to indicate the level of activity in different brain areas. So a difference is between the murderers and the controls. Murderers had low glucose metabolism, so had less activity in some prefrontal areas of the brain. Murderers had less activity in the corpus callosum, structure that joins the two halves of the brain together. The murderers had different levels of activity in the amygdala. So in conclusion, the areas identified as having abnormal activity are associated with a lack of fear, low self-control and increased aggression and impulsive behaviour and problems controlling and expressing emotions. All of these could lead to an increase of risk of committing acts of extreme violence. The study suggests that violence has a biological cause, however, Rain did not conclude that there were only biological causes for violence, just that there might be a predisposition to violence in some people depending on the environmental triggers. And that is the end of 3.3.1. So now I'm going to look at 3.3.2, which is our contemporary study, and we're going to be looking at Lee et al. In 2013, which is the abnormal function of the posterior cingulatal cortex in heroin addict users during retesting, resting state and drug cue stimulation tasks. So we're going to need some background information for the study. So reward, motivation, working memory and neurotransmitter inhibition are reasons for heroin users to continue using drugs. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the orbital frontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex and insula are brain areas connected to cravings where heroin users are confronted with drug-related cues. Lee et al. In 2013 focused on the posterior cingulatural cortex and used fMRI scans to look at functioning in the brain in chronic heroin users. fMRI scans show the level of blood oxygen signals across different brain regions. A resting state is compared first, so researchers can examine any differences between the resting state and the experimental condition, in this case a cue-induced task. Changes in the functioning of the brain between two conditional, e.g. resting and experimental, can highlight the area of the brain that is functioning in both of the conditions. The aim of this study was to measure the brain changes in chronic heroin use against healthy control patients to look at the effects of heroin use. So the procedure Lee used was participants were 14 male and all chronic heroin users, age range was between 25 and 47 years old, and all were right-handed. All were in China in a drug rehabilitation centre. They were all in the detoxification stage. They had to have no psychiatric illness, no history of head trauma or other issues such as claustrophobia, as they would be in the MRI scanner for around 40 minutes. And 15 healthy controls were matched to the participants. They had no drug dependence other than nicotine. The ethics committee of the hospital where the study was run oversaw the research, and the participants gave written informed consent. The study used a matched pairs design, and the study used 2 fMRI scans, one in the resting state and one in the cue-related task state. The resting state involved focusing on the centre of the screen to relax whilst moving as little as possible. This lasted for 5 minutes. The cue-related task experimental task was done by each participant one at a time in the scanner. There was a 490-second exposure to 48 pictures, 24 heroin pictures and 24 neutral pictures. Each picture was shown individually for 2 seconds, then the resting state screen was shown before the next picture. Craving was assessed before the cue-related task and afterwards. Scoring took place using scans of the brain, and volume difference of the brain regions were calculated between the two gaps. It was found the level of education, nicotine usage and age did not vary between the heroin user group and the controls. The scanning showed the areas activated during the cue-related tasks for heroin. The user group compared within the controls were the bilateral posterior cingulate cortex and anterior cingulate cortex and the thalamus, among others. There were clear differences in activity in the scan done during the cue-related task, as heroin users had actively and connectivity between the position of the posterior cingulate cortex other areas, whereas controls had little to no activity. The controls did not show the connectivity around the posterior cingulate cortex that way found in heroin users. There was a correlation between activity in the areas of interest and the length of the time for heroin use. So the posterior cingulate cortex was more active when the heroin users did the cue-related tasks. This shows that cues do trigger habituated reactions. The findings suggest that the posterior cingulate cortex is likely to have an important role in the limbic system, which is an area believed to be linked to rewards and cravings. The dorsolateral striatum was also involved when the cue-dependent task was taking place. This region of the brain seems to relate to compulsive drug-seeking behaviour. It seems to be that connectivity has changed in the heroin user group, and that connections that were found to link to areas found linked to areas for depending for dependency and reward in the brain. Another reason for concluding that the changes in links in the brain come from heroin users is that the longer the heroin use, the stronger the functional activity between the brain areas mentioned above was. So the advantages of Lee's study is using fMRI scans is non-invasive, so it is ethical and easy to perform, and it is convenient for both the researcher and the participant. The participants were checked for claustrophobia, so ethically the experiment should be acceptable. The researchers were very careful when measuring what they were looking for in the scan, and they were careful to look for other issues that may affect the change and the scan data, removing participants who moved during the scans. However, there are many disadvantages. Scanning when cue-related processing was taking place is likely to involve other thought too. So even with the care taken to isolate certain variables that might be affected the functioning they were looking at, there may have been confounding variables. The healthy controls would have had the same condition, however, there might be individual differences that affected the conclusion, as cognitive processes is hard to isolate to just one task. Continually, the sample is too small to generalise, from having just males limits the generalisability further. However, other research has pinpointed the same areas of research as Lee et al., relating them to addiction and reward systems, so generalising the results to say heroin causes brain damage may be justified. And that is the end of 3.3.3. So now we're going to look at the section which is 3.4, which is the key question. And 3.4.1 is one key question of relevance to today's society discussed as a contemporary issue for society rather than as an academic argument. And 3.4.2 is the concept and theories or research as appropriate to the chosen key question drawn from biological psychology as used in this specification. So we'll do both of them at the same time, really. So my key question is, what are the implications for society if aggression is found to be caused by nature, not nurture? And a possible exam question for this is, discuss the key question you have studied from biological psychology. And this question is an AO1 and AO2 split. And the AO1 is the knowledge of features of the argument, and AO2 is applying these features to make an argument. And this is worth 8 marks. So AO1 feature of the argument is that aggression is a universal type of behaviour and is found in all human societies to some degree or other. Aggression leads to violence, which can be defined as the intentional use of physical force or power threatened or actual against oneself, another person, or against a group or community. And that is the definition given by the World Health Organization, also known as the WHO. So an AO1 example of content is that humans are different from animals in terms of aggression. So when animals are aggressive towards each other, it serves a purpose, the protection of their offspring, or attracting a mate, getting food. But humans don't typically engage in this sort of behaviour. Our aggressive seems to be more planned and often no survival motivation, and many argue humans are uniquely violent. However, at least one other species engages in organised intra-species violence, i.e. violence between members of the same species that resembles war. This is our closest evolutionary relative, the chimpanzee. The existence of violence behaviour between chimps and humans suggests that there is evolutionary reason behind aggression that cannot be completely abolished. Another AO1 point is that biological reasons for aggression. For this unit, we know many biological reasons for human aggression: hormones, brain structure, evolution, and genetics. There is one other genetic theory that may be an explanation for aggression, which is the MAOA gene, which is also known as the warrior gene. The MAOA gene, and variant of that is the MAOAL, and it doesn't work as well. It is found on the Y chromosome, and research links to risk-taking impulsiveness. Kerry Friedman argues that the MAOAL gene makes people more willing to take risks, but it also improves their ability to assess critical situations. Friedman et al. In 2010 made 83 young men commit gambling $25 in 140 different games. Each man had to choose between a short option, so 100% no profit, no loss, and a risky option, various risks of loss and chances of profit. The carriers of the MAOAL gene variant were more likely to take financial risks that were beneficial to them, as opposed to the pointless risk-taking. This suggests that evolutionary favours creatures who push their luck by taking risks, but only if they have something to gain. When there is nothing to gain by being aggressive, the warrior gene shouldn't encourage violence. So AO2, applying the knowledge to the argument, and our argument is: what are the implications for society if aggression is found to be caused by nature and not nurture? So if violence is not part of human nature, you would expect other animals to relate to us to be non-violent. If violence is caused by social pressures linked, like poverty and oppression, as the homicide map suggests, then you would expect that animals are likely, like us, would become violent when they were put under pressure by loggers cutting down forests for homes. The solution to violence would be to improve the environment people and chimpanzees live in by cleaning up cities, improving policing, and creating jobs and building schools, and helping the chimpanzees by banning logging. However, if violence is part of human and chimp nature, none of these strategies will work 100%. There will always be violence. However, just because we can't get rid of violence entirely, we could still try to reduce it as much as possible. So AO2 for the warrior gene is that one of the odd things about the MAOA gene is that it actually reduces aggression by helping to recycle serotonin in the brain. People who have the MAOAL mutation actually produce less MAOA and therefore have higher levels of serotonin, which may lead to more aggression. This was first identified in 1993 when Bruner studies a large Dutch family where males had a low IQ and involved in violent crimes, e.g. arson or admitted rape. These males all had mutations of the MAOA gene. So what if crime is caused by nature and not nurture? If someone is predisposed to a particular type of behaviour due to a biological factor, can we really blame them for their behaviour, as they're not guilty by reasons of insanity? If they have a deformed amygdala or the MAOAL gene, should they go to prison for being aggressive or receive treatment? We already do this for other mental illnesses. However, we run the risk of the "I couldn't help it, it's how I am" defence, and more people may be aggressive as the social construction of appropriate behaviour may be altered, and it may stop people taking responsibility for their actions. Treatment for this is that surgery and medication may occur before the person has the opportunity to misbehave. Treatments may often treat the symptom, not the cause. It could like take control over someone's life, and the government may create laws for control over life choices. And that is the end of biological psychology.